that led to my developing this particular product because of my own pain, as we talked about before.
Right.
And this product helped me immensely. And you know, I have to tell you that of all the formulations that I ever made, the nutritional supplement formulations, and of all the things I've ever developed, and I've developed a number of products, I've never had as much gratification from the feedback that I'm getting from people. And for a doctor, that type of gratification is the most valuable and the most impactful and the most important part of his life experience. If people are listening who have severe daily chronic pain and have listened to this show and can understand that this is really something that can help them to decrease their pain that is safe and effective at the same time, I hope that they take it upon themselves to try this out and find out how well it works for them.
Thank you very much, Dr. Frank. I'd like to encourage everyone out there one last time. If you haven't already called, use this toll-free number to get Dr. Frank's Pain Relief Oral Spray. I used it. I found relief. It worked for me. It'll work for you. The number to call, 1-800-256-7851. That's 1-800-256-7851. Be sure to call and ask for the HNN special, and they'll double your order at no additional charge. Plus, you'll get Dr. Frank's book, User's Guide to Natural Pain Relief, free with your order. You just pay for the shipping and handling. 1-800-256-7851. Well, that's all for today. For Health News Network, this is Chris Chandler.
1170 KCBQ, where your opinion counts. KCBQ San Diego, where your opinion counts. A service of Salem Communication. News Talk 1170 KCBQ.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Web Studio, Primetime Advertising Corporation, and the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. Welcome to the program which dares to assert that religion can be a part of your everyday life. Think about it. If God really exists, he is a real entity. And he interacts with reality. He doesn't cease to exist between the Sunday morning service and the Wednesday night potluck. He can be a part of politics. He can be a part of culture. He can be a part of anything. And in that vein, I would like to welcome back the number one radio talk show host on politics and pop culture, Michael Medved. When Michael was last with us, he had just begun a book tour for his very interesting autobiography, Right Turns. The book actually went on to become so successful that even the New York Times wrote a positive review. That has to be the greatest miracle since the parting of the Red Sea. Michael, thank you so much for joining us again.
Well, thank you very much, Bob, and I appreciate the analogy.
Well, before we get into the really important stuff, Michael, I've been dying to ask at least one question to Medved, the movie critic, if you could indulge me. What did you think of the final Star Wars movie?
Oh, I sort of thought you might be asking about that one. I thought it was massively entertaining and well done, and certainly a lot more entertaining than either of the parts, Star Wars parts 1 or 2.
I remember you just hated Attack of the Clones.
I did. Yeah. I despised it.
Did you feel that the kids' acting was a little better in this one?
Much. I mean, I think that actually Hayden Christensen did quite a decent job playing Anakin Skywalker. I gave it 3.5 stars. One of the problems with the film, and I think it's something you cannot ignore, is that there's all kinds of utterly gratuitous bush bashing.
Absolutely. That's what I was hoping you might talk about.
Well, it's just there. It's in the movie. Now, it doesn't make it a bad movie, but it does get in the way, I think, of the enjoyment of the movie for many people. Sort of I mean, look, the idea that there is an exchange at one point between Obi-Wan Kenobi and Anakin Skywalker, who later becomes Darth Vader, of course, and where Darth Vader says, you're either with me or you're my enemy, echoing President Bush, saying you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. He says, you're either with me or you're my enemy. And then to which Obi-Wan Kenobi says, only a Sith believes in absolutes.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the ironies is if ever there were a series of movies that talked about good and evil, it's Star Wars. It just
absolutely
seems like
right.
There's such a double standard that people don't like Bush because he talks about good and evil. And yet when they talk about Bush, they talk about him as though he is evil. It's as if their mantra is good and evil doesn't exist unless we're talking about Bush, and he's certainly evil. It's such hypocrisy.
It is indeed. And you see, I think that part of what people misunderstand about this, and it's very important for people who are biblically literate to explain this to people, is that when people talk about absolutes, absolute good and evil, it doesn't mean that any one person is absolutely evil. It doesn't mean that any one person is absolutely good. For Christians, there is one person who is absolutely good. But for Jews, there's no one ever who has been absolutely good and no one ever who has been absolutely evil. We're all a combination. But part of what you want to recognize is that the fact that human beings are mixed and flawed and complex and full of gray areas doesn't mean that the blacks and whites don't exist. There are some deeds, there are some actions, there are some ideas that are absolutely evil, even though there may not be people who fit that category.
Yeah, and even when people want to argue about whether a particular war is evil, like somebody might argue that they think the war in Iraq is not a good war, or maybe we're the evil people, that still assumes a framework of good and evil in the first place. So they can't really deny that good and evil exists just because they're trying to figure out what pocket the good or evil might be in, it seems.
I think you're completely right about that.
Well, Michael, last week I spent a lot of time on my program, if we can switch gears a little bit, talking about the comment of Senator Dick Durbin. I would love to hear you describe your feelings about his very stupid comparison between America's military prison and the Nazis, and please feel free to be just as colorful as you wish.
Well, no, there are FCC regulations that
prevent
me from being as colorful.
Yes, short of the FCC regulations.
No, look, it's also, I mean, Dick Durbin has totally disgraced himself. I do think it would be appropriate if his colleagues in the U.S. Senate passed a resolution of censure. Now, he's apologized a little bit more. Each apology, it's a little bit more. But, you see, a lot of people have focused on the fact that obviously what he said, comparing America's military at Guantanamo and the interrogators at Guantanamo to Nazis and to the Khmer Rouge and to the communists of the Gulag, obviously that's horribly offensive to our fighting men and women. But even more offensive, even more objectionable, is comparing the alleged victims at Guantanamo to the victims of the Nazis. You see, the people who were killed by the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, the people who were killed by Stalin, the people who were killed by Hitler, all 9 million of them, including 6 million Jews, those people were completely innocent. They weren't combatants. They weren't young men. And you see, even if you believe that there are some people in Guantanamo who are innocent, who shouldn't have been picked up, maybe that's true. I don't think it's true, but maybe it is. These are all young men. And one of the things that we as conservatives and people of faith can acknowledge is that, look, there is a difference between taking a young man and putting him into a military prison for the purpose of interrogation to try to avoid future terrorist attacks, and taking a 9-year-old child and putting him into Auschwitz for the purpose of killing him. 1.5 million of the people that the Nazis killed were children below the age of 15.
Oh, it was reprehensible. They were even putting babies in ovens in Auschwitz toward the end when they knew the Allies were coming. And we're comparing this to what? That somebody had to watch an infidel touch the Quran? Or
right.
Or they had to hear rock music?
They had to hear very loud rap music without an air conditioner.
It's ridiculous. I am so tired of people using the Hitler analogy. It's time to let that man rest in peace, or maybe not rest in peace.
Well, you see, not only is there a difference between the U.S. and the Nazis, but most emphatically, there is a difference between the terrorists at Guantanamo and innocent victims.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, do you think the Democrats are going to self-destruct over these kinds of comments, or do you believe Hillary actually has a chance in 08?
I think there's so many variables, and who knows? My instinct is very strongly that Hillary is going to be very formidable. Will, in fact, be tough to beat.
Yeah. Can you think of any Republicans offhand that would have a chance of beating her? I'm assuming John McCain is not on your list.
Well, I think John McCain is the one Republican who would certainly beat her. And that doesn't mean I support him. I don't, because I don't think John McCain would be a particularly good president. Would I vote for John McCain over Hillary Rodham Clinton in a heartbeat?
It's the lesser of two evils at that point.
Well, yes, Ben, which many, many American elections are. Look, I think that the main thing about this election is there are so many variables. One of the things that was striking to me, Bob, is just this week I have been thinking more and more that it probably is likely that by the time of the next election in November of 2008, there will be some other major terrorist attack on the United States. And depending on what that attack is and how we handle it, that could either destroy the Republican Party, or it could conceivably destroy the Democratic Party, or it could have limited political effect.
Yeah, because on one hand, it could remind people that we're still in a war, so they think, well, then I want the strong wartime president. But on the other hand, I could see the Democratic spinmeisters somehow blame it on George Bush.
Well, they might well say that, we've had all of this expenditure of lives and people's well-being and money to try to make us safer. And look, we weren't safer. So the Bush war on terror should be judged a failure.
Yeah,
on
or
the
they
other
could.
Hand, what could well happen is we have some kind of horrible terrorist attack, and then people point out rightly, well, here are the Democrats who were opposed to the kind of vigorous and rigorous interrogation that might have helped us avoid that kind of secondary attack. There's no telling. It depends on what the attack is. If it's a kind of thing that kills more Americans than 2001, than September 11th, then I think that the American people are going to get very, very serious again, as we did briefly after 9/11, at looking at the nature of the threat from the Islamic world, which is very, very profound, which is very deep, and in which we need to sustain and nourish and work with any allies that we can, including the new government of Iraq.
Yeah. Do you think the Bush administration is doing a good enough job of presenting its case? It seems that when he takes the bully pulpit, he actually does a tremendous job. Much as people fault him for being a bad communicator, I think he does pretty well. I guess I just question whether he does it often enough.
Well, I think that part of the problem that President Bush has is what's the focus going to be for this new term? Is it going to be Social Security? Is it going to be restructuring the tax system? Is it going to be the prescription drug benefit that he was talking about the other day? Is it going to be getting judicial confirmations, a confirmation of his U.N. ambassador, John Bolton? Is it going to be defending the war in Iraq and winning the war in Iraq? Now, all of these are items that at one time or another the administration has tried to concentrate on. And I think that there is a problem with so much going on of a lack of focus for that great number of Americans who really don't count as political junkies.
Yeah, well, we'll continue listening to the ever opinionated, ever stimulating, and certainly always interesting Michael Medved when we get back. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
KCBQ, where your opinion counts.
18 months ago, a big load of debt and some bad business decisions had Betty Quattlebaum waking up in the middle of the night with knots in her stomach. The mortgage was due and the credit cards were full. But today, Betty is sleeping like a baby. Hi, how in the world are you anyway? This is Andy Willoughby with the 3-Step Plan Home-Based Business System. Betty Q, as her friends call her, was in such dire financial straits that she couldn't borrow from Peter to pay Paul. She found the 3-step plan, and today she is paying her bills, has money to travel, she even bought her mom a new hearing aid. For information, go to 3stepplan.com or call 800-895-6545. Betty enjoys helping other people, and she loves the freedom of doing business with a laptop and a cell phone. The 3-Step Plan Home-Based Business System might be the answer to your financial worries. For information, go to 3stepplan.com or call toll-free 800-895-6545.
News Talk 1170 KCBQ.
And we're back. You're listening to the Bob Siegel Show. My very special guest today, Michael Medved. Michael, could you talk a little bit? We were just getting into the judicial confirmations. Aside from the fact that it's considered so important who gets confirmed and who doesn't get confirmed, I can't help but think that part of the problem is that there seems to be a high stake who is going to be a Supreme Court judge, precisely because we're under this delusion that the purpose of judges is to make law or interpret our Constitution. Wasn't the original purpose of the Supreme Court as the third branch to enforce the Constitution rather than to legislate from the bench?
Well, to enforce or to interpret, certainly not to legislate from the bench. I mean, the idea that on everything from environmental policy to the structure of marriage, that the final decision would be made by the Supreme Court of the United States, this is absurd. And while we are out in the world trying to teach democracy to Afghanistan and Iraq, which I think is a good thing, we might well teach it to ourselves and understand, for instance, that when the overwhelming majority of Americans want to continue to define marriage as one man, one woman, it is vicious, it is anti-democratic, it is wrong to have unelected, unaccountable judges telling the overwhelming majority of Americans that they're wrong.
Oh, and the historical revision that's already taken place, I already hear people talking about how the people in Massachusetts got together and decided that they were all for gay marriage, when actually the people of Massachusetts got together and decided they were not for gay marriage, and a judge overturned it. And look at how we're already revising that historically.
You're exactly right. And you see, the point is that people are right, I think, in acknowledging that one of the legitimate purposes of the Supreme Court of the United States, of our whole judicial system, is to protect people from the danger of ever becoming an oppressed minority. But right now, what the courts have done has been to go so far in the wrong direction that rather than protecting an oppressed minority, what they've done is created an oppressed majority. The majority of Americans who hold religious points of view, who hold traditionalist points of view, have simply had their points of view disregarded, their votes disregarded, and told that there is nothing you can do here. See, that's the horror of Roe v. Wade. It's not just the millions and millions of babies who were, quote, terminated by abortion and by the rising tide of abortion, which, thank God, has begun to finally recede. It's not just that. It's the idea that you are now told as an American that no matter how strongly you feel about abortion, you can't do anything about it at the ballot box. You can't do anything about it on the legislative level, which is totally outrageous, especially given the fact that there is not the slightest indication that any single one of the founding fathers or the people who were actually around for the drafting of the relevant constitutional amendments or the 14th Amendment of the Civil War era, that any of the people who drafted these amendments ever had in mind that they wanted to create or acknowledge or to recognize or to shore up a right to abortion.
Yeah, and even though I believe abortion is wrong at any time, I can understand somebody in the first trimester being brainwashed, thinking it's not a life. Nobody could say that about a partial birth abortion, however. And here we have something that's very similar to what the Nazis actually did do, because it's really an infanticide. But that's not where we're using the word Nazi. We're using the word Nazi because somebody has to hear loud rock music in a prison.
Yeah, and isn't that a shame? Look, the entire poisonous nature of the abortion debate for our society, and I think it's very important people understand this, comes not just because it shows disrespect for life, but it shows disrespect for democratic process. In other words, normally what would happen is people would work this out at a state legislative level, and Mississippi would probably have a different abortion law than California. But to have this decision just grabbed and seized by unelected judges is totally outrageous, utterly unconstitutional, and just downright wrong.
And it even becomes the reason that people give. Abortion is okay because the Supreme Court says so. We've made them such a sacred cow, and yet people forget it was the Supreme Court that made that very infamous Dred Scott decision.
Well, absolutely right. It's the same kind of thing. What's troubling to me, Bob, is that the week just passed, there was a lot of debate about this new flag amendment. People say, we don't need to amend the Constitution. We do need to amend the Constitution. I'll tell you why. Because we need to restore the Constitution. It's the Supreme Court that's been trashing the Constitution. There was never a guarantee of a right to burn the flag. That never existed before. They had a case, and it was a 5-4 case in 1989, the case of Johnson versus Texas. And suddenly they discovered one of these other wonderful rights that they're always discovering, which is a right to burn the flag. To get rid of that stuff, to send a message to the Supreme Court, to fire a shot across the bow that says stop creating rights out of whole cloth and respect the actual text of the Constitution for a change, it's very important that that flag protection amendment be passed by both houses of Congress and by the states.
And I'll just go out on a limb and bet that the people who are against protecting the flag would be for some of this new legislation they're talking about defending the Quran, or at least I had heard that they were thinking of passing such legislation. Had you heard anything about that?
Yes, and I'm not sure they're going to be able to do that.
I hope that one doesn't have any legs.
You see, look at the kind of people we are. It's unbelievable. They're every single day of the week, somewhere in the Islamic world, there's somebody in a dirty nightshirt and a turban who is going out there with an American flag and burning the thing and ripping it to shreds and desecrating it. Somehow, that isn't cause for Americans to kill themselves or to blow themselves up. There's one whisper that a total of five times, some infidel may have touched the Quran and people literally are dying over it.
Yeah.
Which simply shows what a... And you see, we haven't responded to any of that by having public Quran burnings. Can you imagine if we did that? I'm not suggesting it, but because we don't do it because we're such a good people.
And yet they would throw the Bible down a garbage disposal in a lot of Middle East countries.
Well, not only that, they'd get an NEA grant for it from the National Endowment for the Arts.
And then they'll destroy people. The question that we aren't asking is, are people more sacred to Allah than some book?
Well, as a matter of fact, I've been attacked by some of the Muslim self-defense organizations. Fortunately, just rhetorically attacked. But I was attacked because I made the point that one of the characteristics of idol worship, and Muslims, of course, are very committed. They claim that they're not idol worshipers.
Right.
Or idol worshipers. But if you treat an object as more sacred than a human being of flesh and blood, then you are an idol worshiper. I mean, it's one of the reasons that the prophets say that they have eyes, but they see not. They have ears, but they hear not. And emphasize that they are just wood and stone, because flesh, a human being created in God's own image, is by our very nature sacred, whereas a mass-produced copy of a book may be sacred in terms of its ideas, but the thing itself is infinitely less sacred than any human baby or adult.
Absolutely. Michael, if I can, I'd like to ask a difficult question, because when we talk about Islam, I know everybody wants to draw a distinction between the Muslim terrorists and your ordinary, everyday Muslim. And I, of course, have met some wonderful Muslims who really are peaceful, and I know that you have probably met many. But it seems that on the media, even when I'm hearing the so-called moderate Muslims, if you listen between the lines, they don't always sound that moderate. I'll hear little disclaimers like, well, 9/11 was a horrible tragedy, of course, but I do hope America's learned its lesson about taking Israel's side over the Palestinians. I'm wondering, is it possible that there are less peaceful Muslims than the politically correct text wants us to believe?
Oh, I think there are. I mean, I've had on my radio show, I had Ibrahim Hooper from the Council on American Islamic Relations, who was shockingly immoderate. I pushed him on this, and eventually he admitted that he would like to see the Constitution of the United States superseded by Sharia, by Islamic religious law.
Well, and
now,
I think
that is not
a
moderate position.
And didn't they have a situation in Canada where the Canadian government was giving the Muslim mosques opportunity to legislate over divorce matters, and the women were kind of up in arms over it because they had been getting some protection from the Canadian government?
Well, see, I don't know about that. It seems to me that it's legitimate if you can supplement the regular law of the land with some kinds of religious procedures. I mean, we do that in the Jewish community, where obviously you want Jewish authorities to be the last word on laws of marriage and divorce. However, you still need to respect the law of the land.
Yeah, and I understand what you're saying, but if I was one of those Muslim women, I think I'd be going more with the law of the land than the law of the Quran.
Well, again, we have a principle in Jewish life, the Dina Malchus Adina, which means the din, the law of the kingdom is the law. and which is very similar to render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. The idea that, yes, you have a responsibility to fulfill the law of God. All of us do who try to be loyal servants. But still, you have a responsibility to follow the prevailing law in the nation in which you live. And neither Judaism nor Christianity has made any attempt, literally for hundreds of years, to try to take over a government and to impose our religious vision based upon the secular power of a government. And
absolutely.
And yet this is very much part of Islam. The only theocracies in the world, anywhere in the world today, are Islamic theocracies.
There are
no Christian theocracies.
We're talking to Michael Medved, our very special guest, from Star Wars to the Quran. A show just doesn't get much better than this. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
KCBQ, where your opinion counts.
The weather is heating up in San Diego, and this can spell danger, even death, to pets left in parked cars. On a warm day, the temperature inside a car can reach an excess of over 120 degrees, even with the windows partially open. Pets can quickly suffer brain damage or die from heat stroke or suffocation when trapped in such high temperatures. For more information, contact the San Diego Humane Society, www.sdhumane.org, or call 619-229-7012.
The KCBQ Listener Line. We asked, and you responded. Here's what you had to say about the station.
This is Mark Cohen from San Marcos. Really like what you guys have done. My favorite hosts are Dennis Prager and Hugh Hewitt. Keep up the good work.
I like Michael Medved the best.
Hi, this is Paul from Mira Mesa. I love Dennis Prager and Hugh Hewitt.
Thanks. The KCBQ Listener Line. Call 866-401-KCBQ. Because your opinion counts. You're listening to 1170 KCBQ.
It's ironic. They're called answering machines, but they never give you answers. Oh, sure, they tell you so-and-so isn't here right now, but you have no idea where they went or when they'll be back. Of course, with GEICO, you won't talk to an answering machine. They have thousands of car insurance specialists standing by, so you always get answers from a real live person. No wondering, no waiting, no irony.
GEICO's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? GEICO, 1-800-947-AUTO.
News Talk 1170, KCBQ.
Michael, we're down to the last 10-minute segment of your interview, and because the time does go so quickly, I want to take this moment before I ask you more questions for thanking you for taking time out of your busy schedule. It's always an honor to have you on our program.
Well, it's always great to talk with you, Bob, and you do a great job and raise a lot of the issues that people care about most, and that's what makes radio so wonderful.
Well, you know, I've told people for years, and I think I told you this the last time you were on our show, I believe that you and Dennis Prager are doing more for evangelical Christianity than evangelical Christians are, and I say that as an evangelical Christian. That's why it's especially honorable to have you here. And you and Dennis, Michael, have taken a lot of flack from your fellow Jews for defending Christianity. I know that for quite some time, Jews have been very suspicious of evangelical Christians. I also realize that's starting to change, but to any Jewish person who may be listening right now who respects you but doesn't trust evangelicals, what might you say to them?
Well, first of all, the best way to improve relationships between the Christian, evangelical Christian community and the Jewish community is for Jewish people to become more knowledgeable and committed to our own tradition. And the reason I say that, Bob, is because for so many American Jews, and I know you know this, if you ask them, what is it that makes you Jewish? What is the one core belief that identifies you as a Jew, a member of this proud tradition going back thousands of years of this proud minority in America? We're only 2.4% of the American population. What is it? What's the one belief, the one essence of your being that makes you Jewish? Most people would probably say, unfortunately, not anything positive, they'd answer with a negative. They'd say, I'm Jewish because I don't accept Jesus Christ as the Son of God.
Absolutely.
Now, you cannot sell a religion, you cannot promote a religion based on a negative.
Yeah.
They couldn't sell 7-Up based as the un-cola. You can't sell Judaism based as the un-Christianity. But see, here's the mistake. Here's where it comes in. Given the fact that so many people, including people like Woody Allen or Philip Roth or so many of the political Barbara Boxer who say, well, I'm Jewish because I don't believe in Jesus Christ as the Messiah and the Son of God. What that means is that you all of a sudden have everything in common with atheists and nothing in common with Christians. And it's why so many Jews identify with the radical, militant, secularist position on so many issues, because they assume that, being Jewish actually is closer to being secular, because the core of your Jewish identity is a non-belief, is not belief. But see, for people like myself, who pray to God every morning and every evening, and who try to study our Bible and are very comfortable with traditional Jewish faith, that's ridiculous, of course. It's very obvious to me that I have far more in common with a Christian like yourself or any other serious Bible-believing Christian out there than I do with somebody of Jewish ancestry who denies God's existence.
Well, you know, when I converted to Christianity out of really a liberal, atheistic Jewish home, I was kind of dragged from one rabbi to another, and they would tell me I wasn't Jewish anymore. One of the questions I would ask them was, is Judaism a religion or a race? If they said it was a religion, I said, well, then why is it that you will consider an atheist to still be Jewish? If they answered that it was a race, then I would say, well, then I'm still Jewish, aren't I?
Right, and I think that that point that you are making is unanswerable. It's one of the reasons that I think the meaningful definition of Judaism, Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan, who is a founder of Reconstructionist Judaism, defined Judaism as a religious civilization. And in that regard, the normal way to affiliate with that civilization is to share the religion, though there are others who choose to affiliate with it simply by sharing the ethnicity. Though I think that's less and less in America today. I mean, frankly, Jewish identity, what people used to call cultural Judaism, is dissipating in this country. The people who are actively Jewish, who are prominent in Jewish communities, would tend much more likely to be people today who have some kind of religious commitment, not just to denying Christianity, but to affirming Judaism.
Michael, when you appeared on my program last time, I don't know if you remember this, a caller asked you your opinion of who Jesus actually was, and you said something to the effect of, I believe Jesus was the rabbi that God called for the Gentiles. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, actually, this is not original with me. One of the greatest Jewish traditional authorities, one of the greatest sages, Moses Maimonides, the Rambam, suggests that that obviously something like Christianity, which has enlisted billions of people in Christian faith and has acquainted billions of people with the true God, this is not an accident. We believe that God controls history, that God controls everything. So this didn't happen without God wanting it to happen. And the question is, what does God have in mind here? Now, you would have your own answer to that. My answer would very much involve the idea of taking Judaism and taking some of its core and making that available to a much wider group of people without the obligations of the law, which I still believe bind all people who are children of the Jewish covenant. There's a very interesting book on this subject, and it's not mine, so I'll give you a shameless plug.
You mean a plug for something other than Right Turns?
That's correct.
You heard it here first, folks.
It's a plug. My friend and colleague, David Klinghoffer, has written a fascinating book called Why the Jews Rejected Jesus, The Turning Point in Western History. And he makes the point that had the Jewish community at large embraced Jesus back in the first century A.D., that Christianity probably would have continued as it was originally as a Jewish sect, where all of the members were expected to keep kosher and to keep the Sabbath and to keep all the Jewish holidays and to keep all the restrictions of Jewish life and circumcision and all the rest of it. And with all of those obligations, which the early Christians do seem to have up until St. Paul, or Paul the Apostle, seem to have kept. With all of those obligations, Christianity then wouldn't have fulfilled its broader mission of reaching literally billions of Gentiles over the years.
So he saw value in the Jews rejecting Jesus to some degree.
Well, exactly. I mean, and aside from the fact that, his book is a very interesting presentation of the arguments at the time and the position of the Jewish community at the time interacting with Jesus himself and his followers in the early days. It's a fascinating book.
Yeah, now I know you wouldn't believe in the deity of Jesus. What is your opinion of the resurrection? I know there are some people who believe that Jesus might have resurrected without jumping to the conclusion that he was God.
What is my opinion of it? I wasn't there. Again, I have, first of all, several times in the Bible there are references with Elisha, there are references with Elijah.
Oh, yeah, the resurrection of Jesus was nothing new to Judaism.
No, we do have descriptions of other people coming back from the dead. So would I say necessarily that my identity as a Jew is dependent upon the fact that, no, he stayed in the tomb or that he faked it? No. You see, Islam, it's interesting because the Quran very specifically says that Jesus was not resurrected.
That is
and
true.
So Muslims would have a very tough time with it. But I try to avoid arguments about the resurrection. I think the resurrection is an essential point of Christian belief, clearly. But is it an essential point of Jewish belief in terms of denial? No, I don't think it is.
I have time for just one more question, Michael. One of the reasons evangelicals support Israel today is because of their belief in Christ and the Second Coming. Now, as an evangelical, I don't always find that the best reason. I had somebody say to me one time, well, I'm feeling forced to take Israel's side because of prophecy, but I'm concerned about the Palestinians and their plight. And I encouraged this person to study history a little better and find some moral reasons. In the short time we have left, could you give us a reason other than end times prophecy why Christians might be concerned about the nation of Israel?
Sure, because Israel and the United States have about the same claim to exist. In other words, why people say, well, what's Israel's right to exist? What's America's right to exist? The right of America to exist is a bunch of people came over to this country with a vision. It was a religious vision. They built a country. Yes, there were other people who were living here at the time. Yes, some of the other people who were living here at the time suffered. But America, over the course of several hundred years, built a country. It's a great country. Millions of people immigrated here, benefited. And it was a country based not upon people sort of just growing up spontaneously or organically in a given land. It was a country based upon a good idea that attracted people. Israel, it's the same thing. Israel, for the Jewish immigration back to the traditional homeland, began in the 1880s. And there was a Jewish majority in that land that the UN declared as Israel in 1948 at the time it was declared. And this doesn't mean that the Palestinians shouldn't be well treated and shouldn't have accommodations made, etc., etc. But for people who actually look at what is going on, the problem is it's asymmetrical. There is no problem at all. The Israeli government and everyone in Israel is willing to accept the idea of a Palestinian state. The question has always been not will Israel accept a Palestinian state, but will Arabs anywhere, including Palestinian Arabs, accept the existence of one Jewish state amidst 22 Arab states in the Middle East.
And on that provocative point, we'll have to leave it. Michael, thank you so much. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Bob, great to speak with you. Best wishes to you and your ministry and to your family, and may you be blessed in all your good work you are trying so hard to do.
Thank you, Michael. God bless.
News Talk 1170, KCBQ, San Diego.
Hi, my name is Jeannie. Because of the three-step plan, I'm able to work from home and be a full-time mom, and that means everything to me.
Hi, how in the world are you anyway? This is Andy Willoughby with the three-step plan home-based business system. After just 2 short years, thousands of Americans are successfully working from home with the three-step plan.
Hello, my name is Bill. I've been working the three-step plan for 18 months, and in that amount of time, I've been able to quit my job, pay off all of my bills, and even began to save money.
For information, go to 3stepplan.com or call toll-free 800-895-6545.
My name is Emma, and I'm a senior citizen, and I've worked with the 3-Step Plan for several years. Today, my house and cars are paid for. I have the time and the money to travel. The 3-Step Plan has given me hope and financial freedom.
You'll need a telephone, internet access, and a positive attitude. Go to 3stepplan.com or call toll-free 800-895-6545.
Are you the type of person that has gone to great lengths to take care of your family and make sure everything is in order, like finances, insurance, college funds? Well, as difficult or as odd as it seems to think about, burial arrangements are something that you should also take care of now. So in a real time of difficulty, your family doesn't have to. Dana Sturgeon here for Singing Hills Memorial Park. They have 35 acres of mountains, streams, ponds, trees, rolling greens, which are surrounded by another 65 acres of wildlife preserve. It's absolutely beautiful. Singing Hills Memorial Park can help you take care of your burial needs now. And believe me, it's a decision that will give you total peace of mind, knowing that a potential future family burden will be much easier for your family to handle. So call Singing Hills today. You'll feel great about it. Their number, 444-3000. And just for visiting Singing Hills, you'll receive a gift certificate for two for dinner. Singing Hills Memorial Park, peace and protection for your family. Call 619-444-3000.
KCBQ, where your opinion counts.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Our toll-free calling number, 1-888-344-1170. It's always fun to talk with Michael Medved when he comes on as a guest. It's also fun to talk with my phantom co-host when she makes her return appearance. Say hello to Sharon Couchard.
Hi, Bob.
You've been very real. Busy this month.
I have been.
Pressing family matters, your son's graduation, your daughter's marriage, small things like that.
Yeah, about 15 people from the East Coast living in my house for a month. That was interesting.
It's nice to have our tech person, Paul, just said to me, isn't it great having Sharon back this
week?
I said, thank you, Paul. But she's going to be gone again next week.
Yeah,
next
just
week you're
for
going
one
on
week.
Some vacation.
Right, I'm going back east for an Arlington Cemetery funeral. So
You deserve the vacation. But you know, Sharon, you're kind of like the mythical Scottish village of Brigadoon. Lately, you reappear every 100 years.
not that long.
You have been missed. We got the nicest email about you a couple of weeks ago from a lady in Michigan, and she said, and I quote, I simply adore Sharon.
Oh, thank you,
I
Michigan.
Said to her, everybody adores Sharon.
Thank you. That was a wonderful interview. You really ran the gamut there. Self-destructing Democrats, judicial tyranny, the Quran, the resurrection of Jesus. Did you miss anything?
Well, when you have somebody like Michael Medved, you want to get his opinion on as many issues as possible. And of course, we are here on KCBQ, kind of a combination political religious show, so I wanted to do a little bit of each.
You know, I loved what he said about the fact that this Supreme Court should be protecting people from becoming an oppressed minority, and instead what we're seeing is that they're creating a oppressed majority. What'd you think about that comment?
It's a tyranny. You may have caught the part of the interview where we talked about how the historical revision is already saying that the people of Massachusetts got together and decided they didn't believe in gay marriage when they decided the opposite and a judge overturned it. And already, what is it, only a year or so later, and look already how it's being remembered. The judicial activism has got to change, has got to stop. Unless, and I always give this disclaimer, if you're a judge out there listening to me right now, I don't mean you. I mean all those other judges.
You know what, Bob? I picked up a book, Men in Black, by Mark Levin.
Wasn't there a movie called Men in Black?
Yeah, there was.
Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith.
Yeah.
I'm guessing this is a different Men in Black,
Yeah,
Sharon.
It is. It's those robed
Men in Black. Well, that's more of a horror than the science fiction movie.
Well, they talk about the fact that it was not intended to be this way, that the judiciary would have this much power. And he simply asks the question, how did this happen? And they grabbed it. They grabbed the power. There is no other explanation.
They really did. And in the very first case where they did rule against the executive branch in Marbury versus Madison, Jefferson didn't even enforce it anyway. He said, let them enforce it if they want to. So the first time it even happened, the very case that set all the precedent, nobody applied it anyway. That's the real irony.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't allow the judicial branch to overstep their bounds. He, the executive, said, no, I'm not going to listen to you.
Yeah, and someone like Thomas Jefferson, one of the writers of the Constitution,
exactly.
may just have known something about
exactly.
what it really
what
said.
What the real intent was.
And it wasn't the purpose of the judges to interpret it. It was to enforce it. That little point has been lost on today's audience.
Mm-hmm. Hey, listen, you brought up a point with Michael about some legislation that might be in our judiciary, I mean, in our legislature
I've been
to
hearing
protect
them.
The Quran?
There's rumors, and he had heard of it too, but I haven't heard a lot on the news. There are rumors that they're going to pass a law making it against the law to manhandle the Quran. And what a disaster that would be, first of all. Second of all, that would really go against genuine freedom of speech. Third of all, you can just bet your bottom dollar no such law would be passed about the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Nor would I, as an evangelical Christian,
want to
see that.
Exactly.
I don't worship the Bible. The Bible is a map to God.
Mm-hmm.
I worship God. The Bible is a menu. I don't eat the menu. I mm-hmm. eat what the menu tells me about.
Mm-hmm. You know what's really ironic about Gitmo is the fact that, how did the Korans get there, by the way?
Yeah, because we gave them to them.
Exactly.
And they're getting 3 square meals a day. I hear they're eating even better than our own military. It's just, and again, we're comparing this to Hitler.
Yeah.
If all else fails, pull Hitler out of the dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you
Hitler.
Who he's like. He's like Hitler.
Yeah,
I'm
exactly.
so sick and tired of it.
Hey, the other thing he said was that, you know, the Jews negatively resist Christianity by saying they don't believe in Jesus. But do Jews actually also deny the existence of God, or just the existence of Jesus being the Son of God?
Well, it depends. I was brought up in a liberal and atheistic Jewish family. Now, I should say my family's not like that anymore. My family became very religious, especially over the last few years, but even long before then. But when I was a little kid, I was taught that it was important to be Jewish. And I was also taught that there was no God. That is not a contradiction to some Jews. Now, to a religious Jew, to a conservative or Orthodox Jew, naturally, they'd say the foundation of our religion is that there is a God. And this God actually came down and spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai. But just like you have liberal Christian denominations, just like you could walk into some dead denominational church and say, well, maybe Jesus rose from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing is to love your neighbor and have a good heart. And the guy doesn't really have any more religion than his horse.
Mm-hmm.
You have that same trend in Judaism, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And there's one other thing, well, actually, too. You asked him a question that I don't think he really answered. Any moral reasons for Christians to support Israel?
Yeah, it's interesting because I've heard both Michael Medved and Dennis Prager speak on this subject. And it is true that you can draw some parallels to the fact that Jews came over to Israel and English came over to America. I think the better claim, though, is that at the turn of the century, there was a British mandate that invited the Jews from all over the world to return to their land. There were Jews and Arabs both living in the land at that time. The Jews had actually been there first. The Arabs didn't go into that land until the time of Muhammad, when Islam first started spreading. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And then it was under the control of the Byzantine Church and the Catholic Church, as there were crusades and the land alternated back and forth between the Christians and the Muslims. But there'd always been a handful of Jews there. And for a while, there was an Arab population because of the crusades, because of Islam. But the United Nations had promised that land to Israel. And for this idea that we need a separate Palestinian state, a lot of people don't know this, 75% of the land that the British promised the Jews was sold behind their back to the Arabs,
mm-hmm.
and that is what we now call Jordan. We have had a separate Palestinian state for many, many years. It's called Jordan. Despite that, the Jews agreed again to take the 25% of the land that was left, partition it again, and they offered it again to the Palestinians. The Palestinians turned it down. That is not being taught on our college campuses today.
Not.
Dennis Prager interviewed a journalism student who wrote this ghastly article about Israel. She was actually Jewish herself, and he told her over the air that the Palestinians had been offered their own state, that they had been offered that back in 1948. She said, that's not
no
true.
Yeah.
He said, I'm very grieved that you could be a journalism student, and A, you could not know that, and B, your professors wouldn't say anything, but C, Sharon, we will be back to talk more about Israel and to take some of your calls. 1-888-344-1170. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
We'll be right back.
18 months ago, a big load of debt and some bad business decisions had Betty Quattlebaum waking up in the middle of the night with knots in her stomach. The mortgage was due and the credit cards were full. But today, Betty is sleeping like a baby. Hi, how in the world are you anyway? This is Andy Willoughby with the 3-Step Plan Home-Based Business System. Betty Q, as her friends call her, was in such dire financial straits that she couldn't borrow from Peter to pay Paul. She found the 3-Step Plan, and today she is paying her bills, has money to travel, she even bought her mom a new hearing aid. For information, go to 3stepplan.com or call 800-895-6545. Betty enjoys helping other people, and she loves the freedom of doing business with a laptop and a cell phone. The 3-Step Plan Home-Based Business System might be the answer to your financial worries. For information, go to 3stepplan.com or call toll-free 800-895-6545.
1170 KCBQ, where your opinion counts.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back. This is Bob Siegel and Sharon Cashard, 1-888-344-1170. We have Ross from Santee. How you doing, Ross?
Hi, Bob. I wanted to know your prediction to an answer that Michael Medved might give to a question.
Okay.
He knows him so well. He's interviewing him.
Once I figure out just exactly what you're talking about, Ross, I'd be happy to give you an answer.
Okay. First of all, he remarked that Jesus was a rabbi to the Gentiles. He didn't go so far as to say he was prophesied in the Bible to be such a person, but he kind of hinted upon that.
Well, of course, now, if he were here, I believe he would say that that's his opinion. I don't think he was saying it in any kind of dogmatic way.
No, I understand. When he gives his answer to this question, I would expect it to be an opinion also, of course.
Sure.
But anyway, would he go out on a limb and say that Muhammad was the equivalent to non-Jewish Middle Easterners?
You know, I don't know. That's a very good question. Next time we have him here, we'll definitely have to ask him. I do know that many times when he's compared Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, he's talked about it being related to God to the degree that it's doing good in the world. I don't think he sees a whole lot of good that's happened from the religion of Islam. I know that Michael has many times commented on the fact that both Christianity and Judaism have had reformations, and Islam has not.
I guess I'd just be a little bit interested in what kind of verbal tap dance he'd probably have to do to deal with that one.
I'm not sure he would tap dance it. I think he would say that there have been some good contributions from Islam. I don't think he would put it in the same ballpark as Christianity. But I am giving you my opinion based on other things that he has said. So I'm contextualizing a little bit. The fairest thing would be to call him someday on his own show and let him speak for himself.
Boy, that's not easy to pull off, but I guess I can try it sometime.
Ross, we'll just have to have him on again here for you.
Thanks. All right, bye.
Thank you, Ross. Take care.
Along those same lines, I was going to actually, that's interesting that he asked that question, a little different twist than I had, but do you agree with his opinion that Jesus was sent as a rabbi to the Gentiles? Because in Matthew 15:24, Jesus said, "I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel."
Let me say this as carefully as I can. Now I'm doing the tap.
Yeah.
I appreciate Mr. Medved's answer. I don't entirely agree with it. If Jesus really was from God, then his message was for Jews and Gentiles both. And as you just mentioned, Jesus did originally come and say that he was for the Jews. Now, Jesus came to the Jews knowing the Jews would reject him, knowing he would, as a result, have his message sent to the Gentiles. But he was originally offering his message for the Jews. Had the Jews gotten behind Jesus, would Jesus have still died on the cross? Yes, he would have, because the Romans would have then gotten concerned on their own without any provocation from the Jewish Sanhedrin. The Romans would have still executed Jesus. Jesus would have still risen 3 days later and died not only for the sins of Israel, but the sins of the world. What would have changed? What would have been different was nothing about the first coming, but everything about the second coming, there would have been no second coming. The Jewish kingdom would have been established at that time. The Romans would have been banished at that time. And it's this first coming, second coming that would have changed. But that Jesus needed to die on the cross, absolutely. And this, of course, was a fulfillment of some of the sacrifices that were made under the Levitical law. And, of course, the fulfillment was that the Messiah became our ultimate sacrifice. No longer do we need the blood of bulls and goats. We have the blood of this perfect man. And, of course, again, the major difference between myself and Mr. Medved is I do believe that Jesus Christ was God incarnate, and he doesn't. But, you know, he said something very interesting, Sharon, that his Judaism did not rest on whether or not Jesus rose from the dead, that there were precedents in Judaism. He gave the example of Elijah raising the widow's son from the dead. And it's interesting because in the first century, a contemporary of the apostles named Josephus mentioned that Jesus did rise from the dead. Now, I hear all kinds of accusations that Josephus didn't really write that. It's a forgery. It's a Christian interpolation. And the reason for that is that Josephus never became a Christian. And they're assuming that for him to believe Jesus rose from the dead, he'd have to become a Christian. But as we just heard from Mr. Medved, one can be Jewish and believe Jesus rose from the dead without necessarily becoming a Christian. Obviously, I'd like to see people become Christians, but that just goes back and authenticates my proposition that Josephus may have been writing as a Jew, not as a Christian, and still as a thorough historian, based on the evidence and the eyewitness testimonies that he examined, claimed that Jesus rose from the dead without giving a whole lot of editorial comment on who this Jesus necessarily was.
And we claim that that resurrection is really the main point on which the foundational point of which we believe that Jesus is the Son of God.
Well, it's very foundational because if Jesus rose from the dead, only God has the power of life over death. If Jesus rose from the dead, what he taught was true. Well, Jesus believed in the Old Testament. That means we have now, through the resurrection, authenticated the entire Old Testament. Jesus also gave special authority to his disciples, who became the apostles. These men eventually wrote the New Testament. So the authority of the Old and the New Testament is authenticated with the resurrection of Jesus. So for Christianity, it is pivotal. It is a pivotal event for us, as the Exodus from Egypt is the pivotal event for the Jews.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? We've been talking a little bit about this atheist website that I hang out at every once in a while.
Oh, those atheists and their websites, and how Sharon loves to go hang out on them.
They talk about some contradictions. They love to especially take a scripture from the Old Testament and compare it to a scripture in the New Testament.
And let me say, I'm sympathetic. I look at different religions. I've had talks with Mormons. I've had talks with Muslims. And when I can point out important things about their religion that contradict, I will make the case that how can you believe in a God who contradicts himself, a God who's schizophrenic? So I'm in sympathy with somebody who would say that there would be a problem if we found a Bible contradiction. I just don't think they're really finding the contradictions that they claim. Mm-hmm. They're at least not on anything of any major importance. We are looking at copies of manuscripts, and occasionally there's a word missing from a sentence, but nothing of any major importance.
And usually they're not those types of contradictions. They're usually, let me give you an example,
okay,
if I can, and
sure,
you can deal with a few of these. And then we can take it over to the...
We'll take it over. In fact, let me remind everybody, we are now on 2 hours on Sunday, so there will be another brand new hour of the Bob Siegel Show on our sister station, KPRZ 1210 on your dial, not too far from where you already are. That will start right at 4. So the conversation we begin here, we will definitely continue there. Just come on over with us. You don't know what they're going to play on KCBQ anyway. Just come on over to KPRZ. In fact, come on over right now. You're always welcome. Your questions are welcome as well.